atheist Bertrand Russell, who in 1927 gave a public lecture called Why I Am Not a Christian. There's been many Christian responses to it, generally saying why I am a Christian, and there's lots of reasons for being a Christian, obviously. At least Christians believe there is, and I'll give some of the reasons that I am a Christian. But I have added the word still, because it's not just a matter of becoming a Christian. It's a matter of living in the modern age and still holding to beliefs that many people think are outdated. And also, having been a Christian for over 60 years myself, and hung in there, and having had not the slightest inclination to cease to be a Christian or to even have a crisis of faith of any kind, because my reasons for being a Christian are so excellent, I believe, you know, I'm still a Christian, whereas some people are not. Some people who used to be Christians no longer are followers of Christ. And so I'm giving my reasons why I still am a Christian, even though I've had many of the same experiences, probably all the same kinds of experiences that anyone has had that has led some to depart from Christ. Now, in his lecture, which I have read many times, Bertrand Russell, again, 1927, his public lecture, Why I'm Not a Christian, he made some comments, a lot of comments. I'd like to answer all of them. In fact, I wouldn't mind doing a commentary on his lecture, but we don't have time for that right now. But I want to read a few of the things he wrote in that, or said in that lecture. It's been published many times since then. Bertrand Russell, the atheist, said, I do not think that the real reason why people accept religion has anything to do with argumentation. They accept religion on emotional grounds. Now, that's only one of a few comments of his I want to comment on. I think he's probably right. A lot of people do accept religion on emotional grounds. And if a lot of people do that, then it doesn't make them very much different than Bertrand Russell himself, who obviously rejects religion primarily on emotional grounds. You know, he was considered to be, in his day, one of the founders of a logical philosophy. And yet, we don't have him giving any real evidence or logical arguments in his talk. I've read it many times, and I marvel at how little in the way of argumentation he gives. And much of what he gives as a reason for his not being a Christian is simply an emotional objection, which is, of course, true of virtually every atheist I've ever talked to or read. Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, these guys who wrote famous books on atheism back around 2006 that all came out at the same time, these guys who are called the New Atheists, if you read their books, frankly, their reasons for atheism, if they are revealing them in their books, are emotional, not rational, certainly not evidential. So I think that probably there are Christians who have become Christians for emotional reasons. Emotion is a very strong motivator for many people in choosing a belief system. I will say I certainly haven't chosen to be a Christian on the basis of emotion. Probably more people have complained that I don't have enough emotion than would ever accuse me of doing anything for emotional reasons. I became a Christian as a child, of course, but I remained a Christian for very rational reasons, at times when it would have been maybe more gratifying in some ways to abandon the faith. But I just couldn't do it. I'm too honest. I don't have emotional reasons for it. My emotions can come or go, and it won't change anything about what's true. And so I've always rested on argumentation and evidence, which is, I guess, if Bertrand Russell is right, that the reason most people accept religion has nothing to do with argumentation, but it's on emotional grounds, and he may be right about most people. All I can say is that doesn't explain anything about my reasons for being a Christian, as you'll see. He also said this in his lecture, quote, religion is based, I think, primarily and mainly upon fear. It is partly the terror of the unknown and partly, as I have said, the wish to feel that you have a kind of elder brother who will stand by you in all your troubles and disputes. Fear is the basis of the whole thing. Fear of the mysterious, fear of defeat, fear of death. Fear is the parent of cruelty, and therefore it is no wonder if cruelty and religion have gone hand in hand. Well, I think actually it is a wonder if religion and cruelty have gone hand in hand, since most religions elevate behavior, or at least recommend elevated behavior above cruelty. It is true that most religious people do not live consistently with the teachings of their founders and of their holy books, and may in fact be very cruel to others in spite of their religion. But frankly, the most amazing cruelty that has existed in all time has come from pagan and atheistic societies. Certainly the cruelty of the Romans, having slaves battle in the arenas, in the gladiatorial games, or even feeding, unpopular people to lions and so forth, and the crowds watching and rejoicing to see them torn to pieces, alive. That sounds like cruelty to me. And actually, the reason we don't have gladiatorial games today is because Christianity became dominant in the Roman Empire, and Christians banished it because, frankly, Christian religion does not sponsor cruelty. Now, have people who call themselves Christians been cruel? I know they have been. But certainly they're not unique in that respect. The communist governments of Stalin and Pol Pot, Mao Zedong, they slaughtered innocent people by the tens of millions. This is not hyperbole. Mao Zedong himself is thought to have killed as many as 50 million. Stalin and other atheist dictators have done as much. Certainly Nazism, if it was following any religion at all, it was not Christianity. And, it's a strange thing to say cruelty and religion have gone hand in hand. The truth is that Christianity has been responsible for the elimination of the cruelty that was so commonplace and which no one in the pagan world ever questioned the legitimacy of. The idea that the Chinese used to bind the feet of little girls so that their feet would be deformed when they grew up and they could only walk painfully for the rest of their lives, that was banished through the influence of Christian missionaries in China. The idea that a widow ought to be burned on the funeral pyre with her husband's dead body while she's alive, that was normal practice in India, but largely due to Christian missionaries, that practice has almost disappeared. This is true of many tribes that were cannibals and would hunt down and massacre and eat partially alive sometimes their enemies. Well, many tribes have become Christians and given up those policies. So to say that cruelty and religion go together, well, I will say that religion hasn't managed to banish all cruelty. But the more devoted somebody is to Christ, the less cruel they will be. Certainly Christ never exhibited any cruelty, which is more than can be said for, frankly, Buddha or Muhammad or many others who founded other religions. By the way, he said religion is based on fear. He says it's based on the fear of the unknown, the fear of defeat, the fear of death. I'm not sure Bertrand Russell thought that there's no reason to fear these things. I think there are things to fear in the world. It's a dangerous world, and people do die. And if they're not prepared to meet God, I'd see a good reason for them to be afraid to die. But it seems to me that belief in Christ, while not reducing our awareness of the real world and the real dangers of the world, has done more to banish fear than atheism has certainly ever done. Not that anyone should believe in Christianity only for reasons of fear, but to say that somebody does something because they fear something else, well, if that's the whole reason they do it, it may not speak well for the legitimacy of their philosophy. But on the other hand, fear is a commonplace in the animal world. Animals are afraid. Humans are afraid, and with good cause in many cases. And if faith in Christ has banished that kind of fear from many people's lives, then I'm not sure why that would be a criticism. The fact that something does reduce fear doesn't mean that the reduction of fear is the only argument for its validity. Eating food banishes hunger. But, the main purpose of food is nutrition. And, hunger, the feelings of hunger are simply a desire for that nutrition. A desire for God may simply be a result of the fact that we need God. And that it is there's a lot to fear if God isn't in your life. I don't really see how this criticism makes an argument for not being a Christian. One more quote from Bertrand Russell. He has said that religion is what people have turned to in response to fear. Well, what does he think we should turn to in response to fear? Well, he says, quote, science can help us get over this craven fear in which mankind has lived for many generations. Science can teach us, and I think our own heart can teach us, no longer to look around for imaginary support, no longer to invent allies in the sky, but rather to look to our own efforts here below to make this world a better place, to live instead, a better place to live in, instead of the short sort of place that the churches in all these centuries have made it. I'm not really sure how he can tie most of the evils in the world to what the churches have done. Of course, bad religion is like any other bad philosophy. And there has been lots of bad religion, and some of the churches have promoted bad religion. But, of course, this doesn't mean that all religion is bad religion, and this is one of the mistakes that modern atheists have made when they talk about religion being a bad thing. Christopher Hitchens' book, God is Not Great, had the subtitle, How Religion Poisons Everything. Well, bad religion poisons a lot of things, and atheism is bad religion as far as I'm concerned. There's a lot of bad religion. There's even bad counterfeits of the Christian faith. And yeah, I think religion is, when it's bad, is very, very bad. I think it poisons everything it touches. However, I'm not talking about religion. I'm talking about Jesus Christ. I'm talking about being a follower of Jesus. Now, being a follower of Jesus has never made anyone a worse person. It's only insofar as we don't consistently follow him that we do wrong. Because when we are consistently following him, we hurt nobody. And we cause no harm to anything. Because, frankly, Jesus caused no harm and taught us to not do so either. So, there are lots of religions that don't amount to following Jesus. But I'm not recommending those religions. I would recommend following Jesus. And that's what I call a Christian. That's what the Bible calls a Christian, as being a follower of Jesus. So this is why, these are reasons. I mean, certainly Bertrand Russell said a lot more, which I'd like to go into if I had more time, about why he was not a Christian. But I want to talk about why I am and why I still am a Christian. And again, I hinted at this, but the word still is being inserted here in contrast to two other ideas. One is that there was a time when there were a lot more Christians in Western civilization than there are now. And the ones who remain Christians may be viewed as sort of recalcitrant hangers-on, science deniers, people who are not informed of progress that's been made. The truth is, I'm very much aware of progress that's been made. And most of the progress in the world has been brought on through Christians who were serious followers of Christ. Modern science was birthed in a Christian environment and was promoted by many people who are devout Christians. Certainly social consciousness, advance in political liberty and justice have been promoted essentially through Christianity. Things that we might think, would be commonplace practices and instincts of human beings without Christianity are not. You can simply study the morals and the behavior of the ancient Greeks, who were very enlightened for their time and the founders of democracy, or of the Romans, which dominated the world for many centuries, and see that it never crossed their minds to believe in such a thing as equality of human life, of the value of human life. They took human life very lightly. And, as far as what we call justice, much of it simply never crossed their minds until Christianity became the dominant thought processes of Europe and many other parts of the world. So anyone who actually is aware of history about these things knows that Christianity has been really the source of most kinds of progress over the broad scope of history, and still continues to be. Many scientific leaders are Christians. Francis Collins, who is very controversial because I think he made some bad decisions about COVID, nonetheless is very up to date in his scientific knowledge. He headed up the Human Genome Project, and that made him rather famous, I think. But yeah, he's a very good scientist, and he's also a Christian believer. And he's not alone. That's just one of the better known ones. But there's lots of scientists who are Christians. So obviously, you don't have to be ignorant of science in order to be a Christian. And science actually developed in countries that were largely holding a Christian worldview as opposed to countries that did not. It seems like the Christian worldview has birthed more scientific progress than any other worldview has done. So in contrast to earlier pre-scientific generations that were Christians, how could I still be a Christian? Well, my understanding is that any reason that there ever was for being a Christian still exists. And frankly, there have for 2,000 years been very good reasons to be Christians, and those reasons still exist. It's just that most people have lost sight of them or never heard them, which is one thing I hope to remedy with this talk. The other implication of the word still, why I'm still a Christian, has to do with my own personal perseverance as a Christian. Many people who became Christians at one point in their life or were raised Christians simply have not remained followers of Christ. They've betrayed him. They've turned on him. They pledged to follow him when they baptized him, when they got baptized, but they basically, just were betrayers and have not followed Christ, although they promised to do so. Yeah, I've just never been the kind of person who could do that. I've never been able to betray a friend. I've never been able to default on a promise to a good person to whom I have, pledged something, and certainly not to my king. Certainly not to the God who made me and who redeemed me. I have no interest in betraying him. Now, people who have often would say, well, I was a Christian until this thing happened. And this thing often is something that some Christian did or some professing Christian did. Or maybe it's just some tragedy that they thought a loving God should not have allowed to happen to them. And then so they give up their faith. Well, I've had both those things happen. I've had an abundance of things like that happen. I've been betrayed by people who called themselves Christians. Some of them were very closely related to me, living in my own home. I've been betrayed by people who worked with me in the ministry and who turned against me for reasons that never were made clear to me. I just count it betrayal, but it never crossed my mind to blame Christianity or Christ for the actions of people who were doing things that he forbids people to do. It only makes me more on his side. You know, when you get hurt by people who betray you, that should drive you closer to allegiance to Christ, because if they had been following him, they wouldn't have done those things. Jesus forbids that, and there's really not much to forbid people from doing those kinds of things other than allegiance to God or Christ. So, when people betray you, it's just irrational to turn on God. I think sometimes people just want to punish God by turning on him, and that's like cutting off your own nose to spite your face. Yeah, oh yeah, that's going to hurt God a lot. It's going to hurt you more. So, I mean, it's absurd. Something bad happened to me. I've had tragedies in my life. I've had loved ones die. I've lost property and things like that. But people have disasters in their life, and I've had a few, but it's just never had any, it never made sense to me to deny what I know to be true just because life is difficult. After all, the Bible did say that we will have tribulation in this world. So if I have some really bad things happen to me, that almost confirms the Bible. Not only almost, but does. It confirms what Jesus promised. In this world, you have tribulation. So this is why I'm still a Christian, even though I've endured some of the same kinds of things that people who have abandoned Christ sometimes use as an excuse for doing so. I think really when people abandon Christ, they are just want to do their own thing and not his thing. And they find an excuse in some negative feature of life that they blame on him. Believe me, there's in some respects, many times I'd like to do my own thing instead of God's thing, but at least when I was younger, I was foolish enough to want to do that, but I've learned through experience that doing my own thing, it's not as promising as doing God's thing. Following God is a better life, and it's a more desirable life, and has better fruit. So I really can't make any arguments for abandoning Christ, so that's why I'm still a Christian after all these years. I can't think of any reason not to be. And again, my point is that if there is a reason to believe in Christ, or ever was when you're younger or at any time before, you'd have to prove that those reasons are gone if you want to justify abandoning the Christian faith. Let me just say what I mean by a Christian, okay? Because why I'm still a Christian presupposes the knowledge of what it is I am and what I'm claiming to be when I say I'm a Christian. A Christian, a real Christian in the Bible, is a disciple who's devoted to Christ. A disciple who's devoted to Christ. The Bible says the disciples were first called Christians at Antioch in Acts 11:26, which means that they were called disciples before that. Now, what is a disciple? According to Jesus, it's someone who continues in his word. It's someone who takes up their cross and follows him. It's a person who denies himself. It's a person who's obedient to his master. So a real Christian is a devoted disciple of Jesus Christ, and that means that they believe in Christ, they follow Christ, they obey Christ, and they know Christ. Now, this last part, knowing him, is a very important part of remaining a Christian. Some people know about Christ. Some people know the whole Bible practically by heart, but they don't know God. And they can tell you everything Jesus said on a subject, but they don't know him. It's one thing to know about a person. I have some heroes in my past who've been dead before I was born, and I've read their there's one hero of mine, I've read five biographies of the man as well as his own autobiography. Now, I know a lot about him, but I never met him. I can't really say I know him, or at least he doesn't know me. So a person is a disciple is someone who walks with Christ, lives with Christ, obeys Christ, and knows him. And that's, of course, the one thing that Christianity allows that no other religion does. And that's that the founder of Christianity is alive. He died, but he rose again. All other religious founders died, and they're still dead. And so to know him personally is the great privilege that comes with being a follower of Christ. Now, I'm going to give you six reasons, I hope very quickly. And people who hear me speak much will probably laugh when I say very quickly, because I don't do very many things very quickly. But I want to give you six things that contribute to my conviction that Christianity is true. And the reason I'm a Christian is, of course, because I'm honest and I know too much to become anything else. And my commitment is to be concerned to know and to conform to the truth. I can't understand anyone who would have any other chief conviction in their life. From the time I was young, I've never had any understanding of people who would not wish to know the truth and follow the truth. There are some things that people idolize above the truth. I just can't imagine what they would be for me. The truth is all important to me. And I believe the truth is found in Christ. And that's what I'm going to tell you why I believe that. The first thing, I'll just call following the evidence. You know, the atheist Sam Harris was one of the ones who wrote famous books about atheism against Christianity in 2006. His book, Letter to a Christian Nation, came out. It followed his earlier book, End of Faith, which I think was out a couple of years earlier. And in that book, which I read when it came out, Sam Harris foolishly wrote, quote, "Consider, every devout Muslim has the same reasons for being a Muslim that you have for being a Christian." I really wish that I had been in the same room with Sam Harris and he had said that to me, because I would love to answer that to him. The truth is, Muslims don't have any of the reasons that I have for being a Christian. Now, Sam Harris and these atheists, usually when they represent the basis of Christian faith, just like when Bertrand Russell did, they think of it as something that people are having an emotional response to, an emotional gratification from. You know, they choose a religion because it's gratifying or satisfying to them and meets an emotional need. Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose Christianity meets my emotional needs. I'm not really aware of what my emotional needs are, but I've never gave them any consideration in seeking to know the truth. I mean, if I'm trying to figure out my bank balance, my emotional needs don't even come into the consideration. I just want to know what the truth is. Let's see if we can get it right. Let's look at what it says. Let's look at the evidence and see what's there. Frankly, if I want to know what's wrong with my car, I want to go to an expert mechanic and find out the truth, because I don't want to choose a theory about what's wrong with my car based on my emotions. And the same is true of anything else important in life. We may have emotions about some things, but we better be rational in our reasons for believing things, whether believing them makes us happy or not. And sometimes Christianity doesn't make people happy, but that would have no bearing on the question of whether it's true or not. If it is, then we should follow it, whether it makes us happy or not. If it's not true, then we shouldn't follow it, even if it makes us very happy to do so. Yeah, but maybe Muslims have that reason. No, the reason most Muslims, I think, are Muslims is because they were raised Muslim. Same reason most Mormons are Mormon. Yeah, there's some people who convert to Islam and some convert to Mormonism later in life, but generally speaking, the bulk of Mormons, the bulk of Muslims, and the bulk of probably Hindus and Buddhists probably are people who were raised in cultures where that's what they inculcated as their beliefs from their mother's knee, you know. Now, that's true of many people who call themselves Christians, too, and of some real Christians. But it's true of me. I was taught Christianity from the time I was a child. And so did a whole bunch of people who went to church and Sunday school with me when I was a kid. A lot of those people aren't Christians now. In fact, it's a surprising the smallness of the number of those who I went to church with as a child who would be followers of Christ today. And certainly, I'm not a follower of Christ because my parents taught me to be. My parents taught me a number of things and values growing up that I had occasion to rebel against. But being a Christian, I had to subject it to the same kind of cross-examination as other values my parents taught me. And some of those other values didn't pass the test, but Christ did. And the truth is, I'm a Christian because I'm an honest evidentialist, and I'm also a logical skeptic. I believe that you have to be skeptical if you're going to care about truth, because most things people say are not going to be true. Some will be, and some will not. And I think we have to be very skeptical about what people say. In my opinion, the problem with almost every atheist I met is they're not skeptical enough. They're told certain things about evolution by their teachers. They're told certain things about religion by their teachers, that is, by their atheist teachers. They're told certain things about history by their teachers. And they just believe them. They're not skeptical enough. I've always been a skeptic. And it's because I'm skeptical that I don't accept nonsense when people present it to me. You have to have evidence. You know, I'm following the sage advice of the atheist Richard Dawkins, who actually wrote this comment in his book, The Devil's Chaplain. He wrote, quote, "Next time somebody tells you that something is true, why not say to them, what kind of evidence is there for that? If they can't give you a good answer, I hope you'll think very carefully before you believe a word they say," end quote. In other words, if somebody says something to you and they can't give you good evidence for it, then you shouldn't be quick to believe them. And I would say, for example, if someone says, there's no God, or Christ did not rise from the dead, I'd say, okay, that's a statement I'm interested in hearing defended. What evidence is there that there's no God? What evidence is there that Christ did not rise from the dead? Well, obviously, I've read the books by those who claim those things to be so. They have no evidence. What evidence could you provide? Yeah, well, I guess about the second point, you could find the bones of Jesus. If you found the bones of Jesus in his tomb, I guess that would prove he didn't rise from the dead. Unfortunately for them, such evidence has never been forthcoming and almost certainly will never become forthcoming. So they don't have any real evidence for what they're saying. And Dawkins says, if someone tells you something is true, why not say, what kind of evidence is there for that? Well, you know, atheism has no evidence in its favor. You can't prove a universal negative. You can argue for one, but you don't have evidence that there's no God. Whereas there is some evidence that there is a God. Now, I realize atheists do not find the evidence for God's existence to be compelling, but I've always thought it's more reasonable to believe a view which some people the evidence for which some people don't find it compelling, rather than to believe something that there's no evidence at all for. And atheism is in the second category. Christianity is in the first. I believe the evidence for Christianity is excellent, but if someone else finds it it's not strong enough, well, it's still better to believe something that has evidence, whether they think it's strong or not, than something that has no evidence. So I'm with Dawkins on this point. This is a good way to approach people, to be skeptical. I think Christians should be more skeptical, and I think atheists should be a lot more skeptical than they are. Now, I have to make a choice among available options. If Christ is not true, then either atheism or some other religious faith system is. The truth will always have the best argument. So a great philosopher wrote that on a bubblegum wrapper that I read when I was a kid, and I've always recognized that as a correct philosophical statement. The truth will always have the best argument, and that's why I'm a Christian. Nothing that denies Christianity has any very good arguments in its favor, in my opinion. Although I certainly spend a lot of time reading these people to find out what they can say about that. Let me read what some atheists have said. Now, this is not why they're arguing against Christianity. This is where they're saying things that almost support Christianity. But everyone I'm going to quote here is an atheist, and a famous atheist, and a scientist, a leading scientist, okay? Theoretical physicist and atheist Paul Davies said this, quote, "It seems as though someone has fine-tuned nature's numbers to make the universe. The impression of design is overwhelming," end quote. The impression of design in the universe, because of the physics, because of the gravitational and other factors, are simply fine-tuned, as if somebody was creating this universe for us to live in. And this is an atheist who says the impression of design. Now, by the way, frankly, atheists don't believe there was design. They believe that nature has no mind and therefore did not have any designs or any purpose. We're just very fortunate that things turned out as nice as they are in many respects. Could have been a lot worse. But no one planned it that way, according to atheists. It's just the way nature brought things about. There was no actual design involved. Now, he said the impression of design, this is Paul Davies, the atheist physicist, the impression of design is overwhelming. Okay, well, if it's overwhelming, why don't you accept it? Well, we'll find out why. Here's another atheist. This is Richard Dawkins himself. In one of his books, which is, comes from The Blind Watchmaker, which was put out in the 90s or late 80s. I read it back in the 90s. The Blind Watchmaker atheist Richard Dawkins says that biology is, quote, "the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose," end quote. Now, the purpose of his book, The Blind Watchmaker, is to prove that nothing was designed for a purpose. It was all nature, mindless chance, and coincidence and so forth that caused bats to develop their amazing sonar and every other amazing thing in creation. It was not designed, but he said biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. Well, if there is an appearance of them being designed for a purpose, what evidence is there that they were not? Where's the argument for appearances being deceptive in this matter? All right, well, in another of his books, or this is one of his lectures, Dawkins said, "Living objects look designed. They look overwhelmingly as though they're designed." So just like Paul Davies, who said the evidence of design is overwhelming, Dawkins said the same thing. They look designed. They look overwhelmingly as, well, if you are overwhelmed with the appearance of things, maybe you could either believe that they were designed or find some good reason to tell us why we should know they are not. He provides none. He tries. Dawkins tries very hard to provide evidence here, but he only ends up giving emotional arguments that atheists always give because they can't. They either do not have as much logical expertise as they pretend to have, or they're just not being honest. The British molecular biologist Francis Crick, who's also an atheist, said, quote, "Biologists must constantly keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved," end quote. Now, why do they have to always keep that in mind? Shouldn't it be obvious? I mean, if they're dealing with truth here, shouldn't the hours and years they spend examining the natural world make it obvious that they're evolved and not designed? Why do they have to keep reminding themselves, this was not designed, this was not designed? Well, because as others have pointed out, all of them atheists so far, things overwhelmingly give the appearance of something that was designed. Okay, so where's the overwhelming answer to that evidence of design? Well, they have none. There is no overwhelming one. And so Francis Crick, again, the same atheist, said, quote, "An honest man, armed with all the knowledge available to us now, could only state that in some sense the origin of life appears at the moment to be almost a miracle. So many are the conditions which would have had to be satisfied to get it going." Now, what do you think? An honest man. Yeah, that's quite a qualifier. Armed with all the knowledge available to us now. So in other words, take all the knowledge available. And these scientists have a pretty good grasp on all the scientific knowledge that's available. They're some of the experts in their field that others look up to, and they write the authoritative books. Okay, suppose you had all the knowledge available about science, as he says. And suppose you are an honest man. Now, you don't find those two things together very often. I mean, if they are together, that's good. But an honest man, with all this knowledge, could only state that the origin of life looks like it had to be a miracle. Had to be a miracle, which means supernatural. Now, scientists are committed to a worldview that does not allow for the supernatural. It's called philosophical naturalism. They say only nature exists. Okay, yeah, but if you have all the knowledge available to scientists today and you're an honest man, this atheist said, well, you'd have to think it's a miracle. Now, let me just say this. Francis Crick does not believe it's a miracle. Francis Crick's an atheist. He doesn't believe in miracles. So either he is not armed with all the evidence that he says we have, or else he's not an honest man. I mean, there's really only two ways you can go. If you do not accept what all the evidence points to, and you have no good reason not to, then how are you an honest man? He says, he's saying about himself. He has to be saying, I'm not an honest man, because I will not say this is a miracle. Another atheist, astrophysicist Fred Hoyle, wrote, quote, "A common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with the physics, as well as chemistry and biology, and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature," end quote. Now, natural selection, the basis of evolution, is said to be a blind force. It's not looking ahead at anything. It's just kind of moving through, and it ends up with what it ends up with. It's not aiming at anything. There's no design in it. Yeah, he says, but there, you know, a common sense interpretation of the facts. Okay, this man is an atheist, and he makes a statement that he says is true of physics, chemistry, and biology, some major fields of science. He said all the facts in these areas seem to point in the direction that a super intellect, we might read God into that, has monkeyed with the physics as well as chemistry and biology, and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. In terms of natural selection, doesn't exist as a blind force. At least if we were following what he says is a common sense interpretation. Now, all these men, I quote them because they all say pretty much the same thing, and they all are atheists. Now, Christians would say the same thing too, but they might be said to be biased in favor of these ideas. These are men biased in the opposite direction, and yet being at the top of their fields. They say that biology, physics, chemistry, all the major areas of science, if you're in command of all the knowledge we have, all the facts, to an honest man would have a common sense interpretation of these that would point toward a supernatural creation. Now, I didn't make them say these things. They're saying these things on their own, in their books, in their lectures. So why would I be irrational to take their word for it? It seems to me that they are the ones being irrational if they say common sense and honesty point to this conclusion, but we aren't going there. We're not reaching that conclusion. Well, then I'm not the one who's ignoring the facts. I'm not the one who's biased I'm the one who's just saying, oh, well, why don't we just go where the facts point to? And I believe we should. So I'm an evidentialist. Now, I'd have to say the same thing about other things. Now, just all those had to do with creation. Obviously, one reason I'm a Christian is because I believe there's a God. And one reason I believe there's a God is because even scientists say that's the way the evidence points. They just don't want to go there. So they go as far as they can with the evidence and say, no, that's not where I want to go. It's strictly a bias on their part, obviously. But believing in God is rational. How about believing that Jesus rose from the dead? Well, that's also rational. And I believe the evidence is favorable for that. And I'll get into that in a little while. But my conviction is, if one can conclude that Jesus literally, truly rose from the dead, you have proven Christianity to be true. Or at least you've concluded that it's true. Because that's the thing upon which Christianity hangs. Some of you may know of a debate I had with a friendly opponent named Max, who calls himself an atheist. He also calls himself Max. It's not his real name, but this was done on a YouTube channel, maybe last year, I forget when. And he wanted to debate me. And I said, well, if you want to debate me, I'll debate on the subject of, is Christianity true? He said, okay. So we got ready for the debate. And I said, the way we know if Christianity is true or not is if Jesus rose from the dead. If Jesus rose from the dead, Christianity is true. If he didn't, it's not. It all hangs on that one thing. And his whole debate was focused on six-day creationism, young earth creationism, a global flood, stories in the Old Testament that he found ridiculous. And I had to keep saying, well, that's not really what we're here to debate. We're here to debate whether Christianity is true. We're not here to debate whether Genesis is true or Exodus is true or whether the Bible's true. We're here to discuss whether Christianity is true. And what is Christianity? It's following Christ, and Christ is true. Once we decide Christ is true, of course we can explore these other parts of the Bible and say, what did he think about them? Because if he's who he said he is, he'd be right about it. And so we can ask, what did Jesus think about creation or the flood or these kinds of things? But that's irrelevant until we decide whether he has any authority to speak on the subject. And that authority of Christ depends entirely on whether he rose from the dead or not. And so the evidence for the resurrection, we'll say more about that in a moment, but that is also an evidential question. Now notice, in mentioning this evidence, I've mentioned nothing about how I feel about things or my emotions or how happy it makes me to be a Christian. This is about evidence. This is about rationality. It's, in other words, not what atheists are about. They are about something else. I mean, if this many leading atheists can say, well, the facts point in the direction of intelligent design, essentially, and a miraculous appearance of the first life, but we don't believe in that. Okay, well, they're simply saying we go by something other than rational evidence. And that's okay. Most people do. They can do that if they want. They might as well be honest about it. I don't. I don't do that. I go by where the rational evidence points to, and that's one reason I'm a Christian. A second reason I'm a Christian is because I take a fair-minded, and by that I mean unbiased, approach to the sources from which we learn about Christ, and that would be the four Gospels. Now, the four Gospels, what are they? Some people say, you can't believe the Gospels. They're just they're in the Bible. Well, okay, the fact that they're in the Bible, that hasn't begun to answer the question of whether they're true or not. In fact, why are they in the Bible anyway? Apparently, there were other Gospels written that we know about. Many have been lost, or at least some of them have been. Luke mentions others before himself who wrote some. Now, he's not talking about what we call the Gnostic Gospels that the Da Vinci Code said there were a bunch of. There are, a few handfuls of Gnostic Gospels have been found, but they were written after the four Gospels in the Bible. In fact, they were written in the second or third century. So Luke wasn't referring to those. There were written documents before Luke. He mentions them, and he says that he had apparently benefited from studying them, but he also had witnesses that were firsthand who were in his circle, whom he knew and interviewed. And of course, Matthew and John, they were apostles. They were with Jesus most of the time that the story records. And Mark, from the earliest times, the church has said Mark was Peter's companion in ministry and translated for Peter, and that Mark wrote his gospel based on Peter's preaching. So we've got the witness of Peter, the witness of Matthew, the witness of John. These are apostles. And we've got the witness of several eyewitnesses that Luke says he's preserving in his book. Now, those are pretty good reasons to believe them. Now, some people say, in fact, it's very common to say, oh, those guys didn't really write those books. Those names were just attached to them to give them credibility. Those are just products of the later church, and they put the names of famous people on them. No, that doesn't work as a theory, because Mark and Luke were not famous people. There's hardly anyone more obscure in the Bible than Luke and Mark. Luke's only mentioned in the Bible like two times, I think. And both of them are in lists of people that Paul gives, that these people are with me while I'm writing this letter. Luke is one of them, and nothing more is said about him but that he was a physician. So there's no reason to take somebody as obscure as Luke and attach his name to a document to give it credibility, since the man himself was extremely obscure. Likewise, Mark. Mark was very obscure. He was the nephew of Barnabas, and Barnabas' name wasn't put on any of the documents. And Mark was even more obscure than him. Now, they didn't make up names and add false names to the documents to give them credibility. That's what the Gnostic Gospels did. The second and third century, you know, people who were not living in the time of Christ or the apostles wrote books as if they were Philip or Thomas or Judas or Mary or and others. And we have these Gospels that have these names on them. But those are false, because those Gospels were written long after these people were dead. These Gospels in the Bible were in circulation throughout the world before the end of the first century, well within the lifetime of many living witnesses who could have said, wait a minute, that's not true, that didn't really happen. There's, frankly, if a person says those Gospels were not written by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, I'd just have to say, okay, who were they written by? If you don't have any knowledge of who they were written by or any evidence of it, then I'm going to go with the testimony of the people who actually received those books from the hands of their authors, who said, who wrote them. Actually, those books were written anonymously. The four Gospels don't have the names of the authors on them. The Gospel according to Matthew, Gospel according to Mark, etc., are names that we give them because the early Christians, the first century Christians who received the books from the hands of their authors personally, they're the ones who told us who wrote them. And again, like I said, they'd have no reason to lie about it for more than one reason. They had nothing to gain by lying about it. They had a lot to gain by preserving the accurate knowledge of where their sacred documents came from, but they would have no benefit from lying about it. If you think they would, you don't know very much about the history. So the Gospels are, I mean, at least all the evidence would be in favor of them being written by people who either knew Jesus or who got their information from people who walked with Jesus, as in Luke's case. Now, that's pretty good. We don't have that kind of eyewitness records for virtually anyone else in the ancient world. We can't find that kind of documentation for the life of Alexander the Great or, you know, Nero or, you know, Julius Caesar or even for Napoleon. You don't find that many eyewitnesses who wrote his life story. And so maybe someone would say, well, I don't believe what's in the Gospels, but there's no good arguments against it. Or is there? Well, one thing that many people would say is they're not true because they contain supernatural elements. But see, that's begging the question. We're asking whether these are authentic documents or not. We're not asking whether we like what's in them or not, whether these documents are authentic history or not. Many things have happened in authentic history, both inside and out of Christianity, that are very remarkable. And maybe you could decide that they aren't really miracles of God, but you can't deny that they happened. Even the Talmud, which is the Jewish writings written by the Pharisaic party that crucified Christ, they admitted that Jesus did wonders. They just said it was sorcery. They said he did sorcery and this, he was crucified as a sorcerer. Well, that was their interpretation, but it was their interpretation of actual events. Jesus really did things that had to be explained either in the way that he explained them, which he said, my Father does these works through me. Or they have to explain some other way, like, oh, it's sorcery. Interestingly enough, the Gospels tell us that the Pharisees accused Jesus of sorcery, that they accused him of being demon-possessed and so forth. So, that's not some kind of a closely guarded secret in the Bible. The Bible tells us plainly this is what the Pharisees said about him, and lo and behold, that's what they did say about him in the Talmud. But the fact that they said those things means that he actually had done the kinds of works that required such an explanation. Now, you can interpret those works as sorcery, or you can interpret them as sleight of hand, or you can interpret them as real miracles, but you can't say they didn't happen, because we've got lots of witnesses that say they did. And there are great multitudes that followed Jesus based on the fact that he did. Most of them wanted to follow him to see miracles. Even King Herod wanted to have Jesus stand trial because he had heard that Jesus had worked miracles. It was well known. Jesus was a wonder worker. Okay? So why do we doubt them? There's really no a priori reason to assume the writers were incompetent or dishonest. Generally speaking, if I read a book that's nonfiction, I will believe it unless the person is speaking out of his depth on some subject he really doesn't have any competence to address, or I catch him in a line. I realize, oh, okay, he's got an agenda here. He's not telling the truth. All right. Well, in other words, we typically accept historical records that claim to be true historical records unless the writers were not knowledgeable of the subject, or we have reason to believe that we can catch them in a lie. But we can't catch these guys in a lie. And the fact that they were willing to die rather than recant of what they said they saw is very significant. Now, I will say that when I debated an atheist on a program called Infidel Guy, he said, well, you know, the apostles died for what they said, but lots of people die for their beliefs. You know, the Muslim terrorists that crashed into the Twin Towers, they died for their beliefs. They were willing to die. Yes, but that's different. We're not talking about people dying for their beliefs. We're talking about them dying for what they saw. I dare say the Muslims who crashed into the Twin Towers believed in Islam, but not because they had seen Muhammad or seen the angel Gabriel give him the you know, the Quran, or seen Muhammad ascend into heaven on a winged horse. I mean, they didn't see any of that stuff. They were told about this. It was passed down for generations, and they simply believed the people who told them. Okay, we all believe things we've been told that have been long held, but that's a very different thing. To die for what you believe is one thing. To die for what you say you saw, what you were a witness of, your testimony of what you saw is what these men died for. They didn't say, someone told us this and we believe it's true. They said, no, we saw this. We were there. We touched him after he rose from the dead. We put our fingers in the holes in his hands after he rose from the dead. Now, if they were lying about that, they knew they were lying. See, people will not, they'll die for their beliefs if they don't know that they are untrue. But very few people would die for any belief that they knew was untrue. And certainly none of the early Christian martyrs, were willing to die for something that they didn't know was true. So anyway, I mean, people can raise all kinds of doubts about these things, but frankly, you would not have the same doubts about any other historical document unless you wanted to doubt it. Because all the credentials that a historical document should have are found to be true of the Gospels. And of course, there is a reason for them to doubt it. And it has to do with their worldview, which is another way of saying their religious faith. A worldview is the assumptions you make about the grand scheme of things in the universe and the world, about what the purpose is, where, what the origins are, what the destiny is of man and of the universe. What constitutes moral and immoral behavior, those are all part of a worldview. You don't actually normally see your worldview. You see everything through it. It's like a pair of colored spectacles. You interpret everything through this worldview, which is your paradigm, through which all facts are filtered. And they have to be made to conform to those, or else your worldview is a sham. Now, the atheist's worldview is that of naturalism. As I said earlier, naturalism teaches there's nothing supernatural. There's nothing outside the natural world. Everything can be explained by natural laws, or it can't, or it's fake. Now, that's an assumption, but no one has ever proved that worldview to be true. What is the evidence for this? What evidence can even be sought to prove there is no supernatural realm? If the most they can say is, well, I never saw anyone walk on water. I never saw anyone rise from the dead. I'd say neither have I, and I don't expect to. But then I wasn't here when Jesus was here. Jesus is not an ordinary man. You know, I've never seen anyone rise from the dead, but neither had the disciples, but they believed it when he did and when they saw him afterwards. Yeah, the Bible does not indicate that we live in a world where miracles are continually happening every time you turn around, and therefore that the miracles in the life of Christ are simply of a piece with the kind of stuff you might see every day. What the Bible would say is Jesus was a unique individual. His era was a unique epoch. God was doing unique things at that time. And to say that he might do unique things if God actually came to earth to visit us, and he might do things that no one had ever done, that doesn't seem unreasonable to me, unless you're ruling out a priori that there is a God and that there is a supernatural realm and that he can do things that defy our understanding of nature. I don't rule that out because that's simply a prejudice. There's no evidence that there's no God. It's simply a bias. And that's why I say I take an unbiased or a fair-minded approach to the sources I'm using. A person who takes a fair-minded approach to the sources, the Gospels, will have no reason to doubt that they're telling the truth. And if they're telling the truth, then Jesus is exactly what he claimed to be. Okay? Many people simply won't believe truth, not because there's evidence against it, but because they don't like the implications of accepting it. You know, Simon Greenleaf was a Harvard professor, and he's one of the founders of the Harvard Law School. And he wrote Harvard's main text on the rules of evidence. He was an expert on evidence. He was also a Christian. But he wrote a book called I think The Witness of the Evangelist, if I'm not mistaken, or The Testimony of the Evangelist. And Simon Greenleaf said this in that book, quote, the presumption of law is the judgment of charity. It presumes that every man is innocent until he's proven guilty, that everything has been done fairly and legally until it is proved to have been otherwise, and that every document found in its proper repository and not bearing the marks of forgery is genuine. Now, this is precisely the case with the sacred writings. If any document concerning our public rights were lost, copies which have been as universally received and acted upon as the four Gospels have been, would have been received in evidence in any of our courts of justice without the slightest hesitation. Now, he's saying the presumption of charity is the judgment where we are with our courtroom evidence. If someone can't be proven to be a liar, you don't insist that he is a liar. Now, when we look at the Gospels, if we can't prove, in fact, we have no evidence at all that the Gospels are written by dishonest men or by different men than those whose names are on them, then, frankly, there's absolutely nothing to object to in them, except, of course, the supernatural. But if you've already decided there can be no supernatural, you're not acting on evidence, you're acting on prejudice and bias. You're a bigot, basically. I'm not a bigot. That's one reason I'm a Christian. I come to the Gospels with an open mind and not a bigoted one. Well, let's go to another reason I'm still a Christian. I see in the Christian faith what I would call a holistic worldview adequacy. What does that mean? Well, I said worldview is the set of assumptions that you have about the whole world and you interpret everything through them. Ideally, your worldview has good explanatory power. That is, it can explain why things are the way they are because the world is the way it is as you understand it. If you have a worldview, for example, that's naturalistic, then you will have a really hard time fitting into your worldview and your belief system anything miraculous, for example. But on the other hand, since any such worldview is completely gratuitous and there's no basis for believing in a naturalistic worldview, it's just a preference, it's just a religious conviction that people have adopted by faith. So every atheist, that's his faith, is his naturalistic worldview. Yeah, but I don't think that worldview accounts for everything. I believe the biblical worldview has much more adequacy to explain everything. Everything that is otherwise inexplicable is rather reasonably explained from a biblical Christian worldview, which means that there is a God who created everything, who has a concern about the well-being of man and the moral behavior of man, and who is offended by the wickedness of man and sent his son to come and redeem man. And that man was Jesus. That son was Jesus, and he died and rose again and commissioned his church, his disciples, to go into all the world and spread the message of his kingdom and his salvation. Now, that's a biblical worldview. It has something to say about the purpose of life, which a good worldview must. It has something to say about the origin of life. It has something to say about the end of the world. It has something to say about what morality is, what it looks like. I mean, it basically is a philosophical kit that naturally, without forcing or without twisting, explains virtually everything. Now, among the things that the biblical worldview does explain, but which atheism or the naturalistic worldview does not, are the following things. The first cause of all things. You know, Bertrand Russell, living 100 years ago when he spoke that speech, he didn't know what scientists now know and take for granted. He argued against Christianity because the Christians say there had to be a first cause, and that first cause is God, and he made everything. But he said, why did there have to be a first cause? Why couldn't the universe have simply always been here? This is what they call the steady state theory, which most scientists held in his day. Of course, he's the one who's outdated scientifically, not us. The truth is that in the 1950s, through the Hubble, experiments and so forth, it became clear that the universe is expanding. It's expanding rapidly. And apparently has been doing so, as near as we can tell, since it began. But that means it began, because it can't expand forever unless it begins in a certain place and expands from that point. And this was a very unpopular view among atheist scientists. They did not like this, what they call the Big Bang theory. Einstein didn't like it either. Einstein tried to refute it, but later in his life he repented of that. He didn't become a Christian. He just acknowledged he had been wrong, that the Big Bang does seem to fit all the evidence. Now, that means that the universe had a beginning. And whatever has a beginning has to have some cause of its beginning, some first cause. Now, obviously, the Big Bang, if it really happened, was caused by something. But the Big Bang is said to be the very beginning of all matter, energy, and time. So whatever caused it had to be around independently of matter, energy, and time. And the only thing we can even fathom would be God. Now, it could be something else, but the Christian worldview answers the question in a rational way. Now, somebody says, and I used to give talks about evolution and creation in science clubs in high schools and some biology classes in colleges in various places. And I'd have Q&A, and the students would always say, well, where did God come from then? As if that was the real stumper. And, what I said was, we don't know where the first cause came from. Obviously, by definition, it didn't come from anywhere. The first cause is the very first thing there was. But if you reject God as the first cause, you haven't escaped the problem. Something was the first cause. And if you don't have God, you've got nothing but matter and energy. That's what scientists believe began at the Big Bang, is matter and energy. It didn't exist before, and nothing existed before. Well, then... okay, then everything came from nothing. That doesn't make any kind of scientific sense. It's just a faith statement. The truth is, you either, in order to be rational, have to believe there is eternal matter and energy, or an eternal intelligent being that caused everything to happen. Atheists go with the matter and energy story. But the problem with that is there's a scientific law that all scientists acknowledge and has been well known for ages, and that is, for every effect, there must be an adequate cause. Well, everything around us is the effect of some cause. Nothing around us is self-caused. It was caused by something before it. Each of us have been caused by our parents. And our parents were caused by their parents. The house I'm in is caused by builders. Everything I observe was caused at some time. But every effect has got to have a cause adequate to produce it. So what cause is adequate to produce the effects in the universe, among which are incredible energy in the stars and other bodies, in the atoms and so forth, Well, then the cause that caused it had to have great energy, but more than energy, had to have intellect, because intellect exists as a product of something. Now, if someone wants to tell me that you can take a handful of dirt and make a scientist out of it, then you've got greater faith than I have. The truth is, life itself has never been observed to come from non-living sources. It's always the effect of a cause that is living. Science has found no exceptions to this. They're trying, but they have found none. If they ever manage to create life in a test tube, which they've not done yet, it will only show that they, the experimenters, were necessary to make it happen. So the life came from living sources, reorganizing materials. That still proves that life can only come from life. No exception is known, and scientists are not able to at all explain. Richard Dawkins himself, in an interview, was asked, where did the first living thing come from? He said, we have no idea. No idea. Okay, so, but you would say it came out naturally. What evidence is there for that, Mr. Dawkins? Actually, you're the one who said we should ask that question. What evidence is there for that? Okay, well, the evidence that God is the first cause, frankly, is very adequate, because God, by definition, is intelligent and powerful and has a will and has designs and purpose. And therefore, when Dawkins says in one of his speeches, everything you look at looks like overwhelmingly like it was made by design for a purpose, he's basically saying, yeah, it looks like the Christian worldview is correct and the naturalist worldview isn't. Bunga still holds to the latter, because I want to be an atheist. It would explain why there is information in the every DNA molecule. No living thing exists without a DNA molecule in every cell. And the DNA molecule is information. Scientists say that the information in the DNA molecule is more than that which is found in the entire Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, what we have to understand is the entire Encyclopedia Britannica cannot be produced just by getting so many pages and so many cardboard covers and so much ink and so forth, or even by, scattering letters on the pages. What is in the Encyclopedia Britannica is not just random letters. They are organized so as to communicate something. And there is no place in the universe that science have ever observed information, which by definition is one mind trying to communicate to another, or give instructions to another. Information is, detailed or not detailed, but it's one person communicating to another. And so a rock cannot produce information. If you're stranded on an island with a friend and you find shelter in a cave and you're speculating about whether any other humans have been on that island before, because you haven't seen any, and one of you says, no, there's not, never been anyone here, I think we're the first, and the other says, no, I think there is. One thing that would solve the problem right away is if you found a cave drawing, or more importantly, a cave message scrawled with charcoal on the cave wall saying, I was shipwrecked here at such and such a date and was rescued at such and such a date. Now, that's information. And as soon as you see information like that, it's not a coincidence. There wasn't some beetle that dragged that charcoal up there randomly. That some mind produced that information. And that's exactly what the DNA molecule has, but not just a little bit. As much as the whole information content of the Encyclopedia Britannica. If there's not a mind behind that, well, I should say, if we would say there's not a mind behind that, we are simply ignoring all the evidence that scientists have ever seen on any subject. The SETI project out in the desert where they've got these big disks aiming out at space, they're looking for messages from space to see if there's life out there. They haven't really gotten any yet, I don't think, but suppose on one unusual night, the monitors at their computers did receive a message, a coded message, and it said, resistance is futile, surrender, earthlings. Well, that's a very short message, but there'd be no doubt that that came from a mind. There'd be no doubt that that kind of information would testify to some extraterrestrial life or some life out there sending the message. Now, why is it that they would know that then? But when you see incredible amounts of information in every cell of every living thing, somehow they can't recognize there's a mind trying to communicate. The Christian worldview explains that. A naturalistic worldview does not. And what about purpose in life? The naturalistic worldview asserts there is no purpose in life. There's no purpose. It's random. It's an accident that we're here. The universe didn't know we were coming. It just accidentally became an accommodating place for us. I like a quote from Sir John Templeton, who said, "Would it not be strange if the universe, without purpose, accidentally created humans who are so obsessed with purpose?" That is an interesting thing, because all other creatures are obsessed with things like finding food, finding mates, finding shelter, finding security. And what's interesting is they have all these instincts because such things exist. There is such a thing as food. There is such a thing as a mate. There is such a thing as shelter. And as far as we know, biological creatures, at least if natural selection produced them, would not produce creatures that had a craving for something that isn't there, that doesn't exist. Why would people be so obsessed with purpose? Why are there philosophers at all? If there's no purpose, certainly the Christian worldview would answer, well, because God has a purpose and he created us to know and follow that purpose. So that makes sense. If there's no purpose and no God, well, why do people think that's so essential to living? I think most people who commit suicide do so because they have not found any purpose for living. But there is purpose, but only if the Christian worldview is correct. It's a holistic worldview adequacy that Christianity has that that nothing else does. Morality, of course, is one of the great arguments for God, the moral argument. But, you know, atheists will say, no, we don't need goddamn morality. We could figure it out without God. We could figure out that it's harmful to hurt certain people and we should avoid doing things that do hurt people. Well, wait, no, you just said should? Where does the word should come from? It's true that if there's no God, if we're just animals, if we evolved like all other animals from simply survival of the fittest, then how would it be said that I shouldn't kill somebody who's less fit than me? That's how I evolved. Every generation of creatures before me, that's how they survived. They killed and exploited weaker specimens. Who's to say we shouldn't do that? Well, God would say we shouldn't do that. But evolution can't tell you that we shouldn't do it. You can't discover a universal morality without there being a being that has a concern about morality that is somehow revealed or written into our hearts. And I won't go further with this, although, you know, this is a very common argument that atheists think they can refute, and I've read their arguments, but they all ignore the fact that they all believe in morality. They all believe there are things that in other words, a society doesn't create morality. A society either conforms to good morality or it does not. You know, the Nazi German regime created a Nazi morality, but we say it's not okay. Why? What are we judging it by? Our own? Well, why should they be judged by ours? But we would say that no, our morality and theirs relate differently to an absolute morality. We try to approximate it more than they did. And they ignored it and violated it. But if morality is simply something that society creates for itself, and you know that's what morality is, then frankly, Nazi Germany was just as moral as America was in trying to restore people who were taken captive by the Nazis. Now, if there's no absolute morality, then we can't criticize anyone. This also becomes a criticism of one of the main arguments of atheism. In Bertrand Russell's thing, he said, he was kind of mocking Christianity. He said, if there's a God, couldn't he come up with something better than Nazism and the KKK? In other words, you see a lot of evil in the world. Wouldn't God come up with something better than that? Yeah, actually, God did come up with a lot of things better than that. In fact, we have no reason to believe God came up with Nazism or the KKK. It seems to me those organizations and philosophies came about from human beings. God didn't create those or institute those. But didn't Russell say, couldn't God come up with something better than Nazism? Well, by what standard do you measure if something is better or worse? Is there an absolute morality that the Nazis did not conform to and that we do? Is that why we're better than them? If there's no absolute morality, then of course there couldn't be anything better than Nazism, or worse. There just couldn't be anything that this is on a moral scale comparable to anything else, because there's no morality. But everyone knows there is. Even atheists know there is. They even use it. You know, if they say, how could a good God allow evil in the world? Well, where'd you get your idea of evil? What is evil? You mean immoral stuff? What makes it immoral? If you don't believe there's an absolute morality, then you can't criticize God for violating whatever morality you have created in your own head. He is not beholden to your morality. You're beholden to his. But if there is an absolute morality and God, and you could criticize God for violating it, then who's the source of that morality, if not God? Anyway, the atheists simply, their worldview just goes in a circle. They really do not have an adequate worldview. And frankly, they think that Christians have a hard time with there being suffering and evil in the world. Well, I think everyone does. Who likes suffering and evil? However, the Christian worldview accounts for it in the rebellion of man against God and the deterioration of the perfect creation that God made. That's part of the Christian worldview, and that accounts for virtually all kinds of evil and suffering. But it also even says that a good God is willing to use suffering as a means to cure us of our evil. And sometimes nothing will cure us of our own innate evil more than the suffering of evil from others. It awakens us morally. It turns us to God and other things like that. Yeah, I mean, there may be good reasons for God to allow suffering. But if one's an atheist, why do you think there's evil? You know, how do you explain the presence of evil or even the category of evil? If evolution is an amoral, purposeless process, and every creature has evolved from others by simply exploiting and destroying its competition, and that's normal, that's just the way the world is, then how can you say it's not moral for us to do the same thing? Maybe that's the way that we'll reach a higher species. I mean, if we got here that way, maybe the next better species would. But everyone knows it's not okay. It's not okay to kill children. I mean, everyone knows it because of Christianity. The Romans didn't know that. The Greeks didn't know that. They would expose infants that they didn't want to be eaten by dogs. They'd throw them in the river. Now, we consider that barbarous. Why? Because we're Christians. And because Christianity has infiltrated our world where we live and has even changed the part of the world that Rome and Greece were dominating. So Christianity is not the one with the problem of evil. The Christian worldview accommodates the existence of evil and actually makes every effort to remedy it, but has an explanation of why some things are evil, because they don't please God. That's why. One other thing that the worldview, I think, holds, the Christian worldview, it explains demonic activity in ways that naturalism does not. And the only thing an atheist can do is deny that there is demonic activity. They can say that everything that has in ancient times was called demonic possession is actually just, some kind of a disorder of the mind, mental illness, paranoid schizophrenia, something like that. Well, they can say that until they actually learn something about the subject. If you actually get out on the field where demon possession is encountered and dealt with, many psychiatrists who are not necessarily Christians have a category of illness that they call possession syndrome, where there is some kind of another mind, another kind of an evil entity controlling a person. And, you know, maybe a lot of things that demon-possessed people would resemble what mentally ill people would do, but levitating is not one of those things. Mentally ill people can't levitate because they're mentally ill. Demons have caused that to happen. It's been witnessed by many modern observers, including critics. For a demon-possessed person to speak with multiple voices, sometimes at the same time, out of the same throat, in languages they've never learned. Yeah, that's happened too. That's been observed many times. How does science explain that? Speaking languages you've never learned, and several at the same moment, simultaneously. There are things. How is it that demons can be cast out of one person and go into animals or into other people? Do mental illnesses do that? I have to say that the phenomena, which has been observed in every culture in the world throughout history, which the Bible calls demon possession, is very well explained in terms of the biblical description and not explained at all in terms of a naturalistic one. The next thing, the fourth thing, is the reason I'm a Christian still, is because I am willing to assess the probabilities of things. What are the chances that life came about from non-life? Well, as far as we know from science, zero to none. And yet, life did come about. It is here. If God made life, that explains everything. And what is more probable, that God made life or that life made itself? Now, the only way someone would decide what's more probable, or let's just say would decide that it's more probable that life made itself, is if the whole concept of there being a God was ruled out prior to consideration and prior to investigation. If you say, well, it can be anything except God. Okay, well then go at it. Do your best. Tell us how life, you know, came about without God. When Richard Dawkins was interviewed about this, he said, we have no idea. But then he said, there's one possibility that some highly evolved forms of life on another planet may have seeded this planet with living cells, which began to evolve. And his interviewer said, okay, so you're not against intelligent design as long as it's not God. If aliens from another planet intelligently designed life on the planet, that's okay with Richard Dawkins. It's not okay if God did. Well, but you see, if you're saying life began here because some other planet had beings, living beings, intelligent beings that seeded it here, you haven't really explained where life came from at all. You've just transported the problem to another planet. And maybe you could keep transferring to other planets before that. But where do you start it? Where did life begin? And, you know, this is the problem, that the probabilities of it happening just aren't suitable under the naturalistic worldview. So, assessment of probabilities is addressing the question, what are the chances of this? What is the chance that God exists or doesn't exist? Well, as I said, I quoted scientists who are atheists at the beginning saying, all of them say, you know, if you went by the way things look overwhelmingly and you followed common sense and you were an honest man in possession of all the facts, you'd have to kind of look in the direction of special creation. Yeah, but they don't want to do that. The probabilities of God existing are enormous given the alternative that God doesn't exist and all the design in the universe, in the biosphere, in chemistry, in physics, in biology, that all of that stuff happened without intelligence. Well, you're welcome to believe that. To believe that, a creature evolved that's more like a worm than an insect, but it goes into a cocoon and comes out an insect with entirely different body parts. And in between, while it's in the chrysalis, it turns into liquid. So a caterpillar makes a chrysalis. It liquefies. It becomes a nutrient broth. And then within the chrysalis, it reassembles itself into an entirely different animal. One with wings, one with legs, one with, tripartite anatomy, like all insects. But the caterpillar didn't have any of those characteristics. How'd that happen without intelligent design? I mean, I could see an intelligent God doing that just to make us scratch our heads and say, well, that must be a God, you know. But I can't see any way that a natural process would be, or evolution. You see, if evolution is true, then there had to be a caterpillar initially that didn't turn into a butterfly and didn't go into a chrysalis state. And yet, at some point, the caterpillar decided that it would do that, starts wrapping itself in silk, and it liquefies. And yet, let's just say it hasn't evolved to the point where it can reassemble itself as an insect. Well, that's the end of that line. As soon as that caterpillar is liquid, which, of course, is inexplicable, how could a caterpillar turn into liquid? But it does. But once it's gone, it makes itself from nothing? Okay. Nature's full of these kinds of things. So what does the scientist say? Well, the scientists who are atheists say that we Christians invoke God as a God of the gaps. Do you know what that term means, a God of the gaps? It means that where there are still gaps in our scientific knowledge, we invoke God. In days long ago, people thought there was a volcano God that made the volcano erupt. There was a hurricane God that made the hurricanes come. But now we have scientific explanations for us. We don't need God for that. And so the gaps in our knowledge are closing, and God, who only had place to occupy those gaps in our knowledge, is being squeezed out by increased knowledge. That's called the God of the gaps. But you know what? It's a ridiculous thing to say, unless they want to say that they have an evolution of the gaps, because they can't explain scientifically how a caterpillar evolved into this, how a reptile evolved into a bird, how a land mammal evolved into cetaceous, animals like whales and so forth. They have guesses. They can pretend. They don't have anything like a complete fossil record that would document it. Evolution did that. Okay, so if we would say God did that, we're invoking the God of the gaps. If they say evolution did that, are they not invoking an evolution of the gaps? That's their God. That's their go-to when they can't explain something, just like we have God. But we can explain it in our worldview. The Christian worldview explains it naturally enough. Their worldview does not. Okay. On this matter of assessment of probabilities, what are the chances that Jesus was not who he claimed to be? Okay? Given the fact that his life fulfilled multiple prophecies that the ancient prophets had said the Messiah would do, these are not prophecies that he made happen. Now, some of them would be things that would be in his power to make them happen, but not things like where he'd be born and what generation he'd be born in. We don't make decisions about where we're going to be born or what generation we'll be born in. How much Judas would be paid by the enemies of Christ to betray him. How Jesus would die. He couldn't make himself be crucified. That was a Roman choice. Many times the Jews, Jesus didn't do anything to offend the Romans. He did things constantly to offend the Jews, and they always took up stones to stone him. That's the way the Jews killed people, is stones. How could it be predicted that he'd die of crucifixion and him engineer that when he didn't do anything to arouse the Romans' ire? He didn't confront them at all. He rebuked the Jews. He certainly acted in such a way that was likely to get him killed by stoning, but he did nothing that would likely get him crucified. And yet the prophet said he would be crucified, and he was. I mean, anyone who minimizes the profundity of these prophecies and their fulfillment in Christ's life by some kind of a lame excuse is simply a person who's willing to have lame excuses rather than facts and truth. These are things I've been studying for 60 years, and I've studied them critically because I'm naturally a skeptic. If my answers don't have solid backing, I would be skeptical of it. But they do, and only people who don't seem to know much about these things think they've got a case. The fifth thing, after assessment of probabilities, is the risk-benefit analysis. Of course, this is sometimes referred to as Pascal's wager, which is not a way of knowing something, but it gives a reason for believing something. And certainly, I think every Christian has something of this, that if Christianity is true, it is more advantageous to believe it than not, because there are eventual eternal consequences, perhaps, if we don't believe it. On the other hand, if Christianity is not true, there's no disadvantage in believing it. If Christianity isn't true, and I believe it till the day I die, I've lost nothing. If anything, I've had a better life. I've done more good for the world. I've enhanced the lives of others. I've lived a cleaner life, probably a healthier life. I've lived a happier life. Now, are these bad things? I mean, what if Christianity wasn't true and I still believed it and these results were in my life? Would that be something for me to regret that I believed it? And of course, if it wasn't true and I died, I wouldn't regret it anyway because I wouldn't exist. So, I mean, there's really no risk in being a Christian except the risk of being killed as a martyr or persecuted. But then, people can be killed and persecuted and unpopular and mocked and beat up by bullies who don't have any belief in Christ at all. It's true, there are certain dangers in being a Christian, but those dangers are not necessarily greater than the dangers of simply being a human being living in this world. Everybody dies, and many people suffer loss and persecution and mockery and things like that before they die, even if they're not Christians. So again, to say, well, you're invoking those problems if you're a Christian, and it's not true. But frankly, I don't even have any doubts that it's true, because I go by the evidence. I would have reason to doubt atheism to be true, or Islam, or any other religion that doesn't have evidence in its favor. But frankly, if the Gospels are true, and like I said, I take a fair-minded and objective approach to those sources, then Christ is true, and the other religions are not, and atheism is not. In other words, we're not left to guess. We have a witness of his life. And if the people who wrote those things were convinced that he did those things, then I have every reason to believe I would be convinced too if I lived back then. Thankfully, these guys were honest men and proved it by their willingness to die as martyrs for what they saw and testified to. But of course, what are the risks? If suppose Christianity is not true and I believe it anyway, what am I losing here? Don't I lose some of my freedom and dignity by seeing myself as a servant of a higher master? No. Everybody's a servant of some master. If you're simply a slave of your own lusts, that's not the most dignified, life you can live. Or the slave of, of society, or of anything. Being a slave of God. That's the most dignified slavery you can have, and no one escapes slavery. You got to serve somebody. And so, no, I don't lose any dignity by becoming a follower of Christ. But what if I have to deny myself many pleasures and indulgences? Well, yeah, doesn't everyone have to do that anyway? I mean, doesn't every decent person have to deny himself many pleasures and indulgences? I mean, can you just go sleep with your neighbor's wife because you find her attractive? Can you steal your neighbor's car because you like it? No, decent people don't do that. Neither do Christians. Am I a worse person or live a worse life because I don't do those things? No, I think I'm a better person. Probably live with a cleaner conscience, among other things. Christianity, of course, makes me delay gratification to a later time, and to put myself behind others in my concerns, to put others ahead of myself, to avoid broken relationships, health deterioration, legal consequences. If I put others first, I will be happy. I know that from experience. And I will I'll cause fewer problems for other people and get myself into less trouble in most cases. So, frankly, even if Christianity were not true, I'd say it's still the best way to live. I can't think of any better way to live, and I can't think of any unbeliever that lives in a way that I envy. Now on our last point, I have had experience with God and with Christ. Now, obviously, this is no doubt thought to be the most subjective part, and I saved it for last so that one would know that my main reason for being a Christian isn't because how I feel about it or what I think I've experienced or anything like that. My main reason is for rational, evidential reasons, and because I'm very skeptical of any idea that doesn't have evidence, and I'm very favorable toward ideas that do. And those are the main reasons I'm a Christian. But in addition to that, genuine Christianity also involves an experience of transformation of life. I know myself to have started out my life as a very selfish person, a very egotistical person, a very covetous person. In other words, I was mostly like most people are. And following Christ has made me a different kind of person. In a way, I like to be different. I don't like being covetous. I don't like to be egotistical. I don't like to be one who's driven by my lusts. And Christ alone is able to set us free. His name should be called Jesus, the Bible says, because he saves his people from their sins. My experience has been that I have been saved from my sins. That doesn't mean I've never sinned. It just means that it's very uncharacteristic for me to sin because my life is aimed a different direction. And I've often made the example of a vegetarian being somebody who doesn't eat meat. Well, sometimes they do. Vegetarians sometimes fall into the temptation to eat meat, but that doesn't change the fact that they are committed vegetarians. It means they have to recognize they did something contrary to their convictions and do better to not do it next time. And that's how they would feel about it if they're convinced vegetarians. When you're a convinced follower of Christ, you're determined not to sin, not to displease him. You're determined to do his will. Now, you won't do it perfectly all the time, and I certainly don't. But the trajectory of your life will be in the direction of righteousness. And I've never seen that to be opposite in anyone who's taken Jesus seriously and really been a disciple of his. It's one of the things that's great about being a real disciple of Christ is that you can know God other than by hearsay. Most people have heard of God. Some don't believe what they've heard, and some do. But many people know him only by hearsay. They simply have adopted beliefs about God, but they don't know him. And yet the Bible indicates that when we become true followers of Christ, he gives us his spirit. He bears witness with our spirit that we're children of God. He communicates with us. He interacts with our lives. And certainly that has been my testimony. I wouldn't trade that for the life of any atheist I've ever met. What do they have that I don't? Only stuff that I wouldn't want, frankly. Now, I will say this. My personal experience has not only been about how I feel inside. It has to do with my outward circumstances, too. It has to do with prayers being answered. It has to do with providences of God in my life. Now, I debated an atheist once who said, well, experiments have been done proving that prayer doesn't change anything, and therefore it's worthless. And I said, You can't do a scientific experiment with prayer because prayer is a child asking his father for something. And the father may or may not grant it as the father sees fit. You can't do a scientific experiment about whether a father exists because a child asks his father and doesn't get what he asks for sometimes. The father's free will would foul up any predictability in the experiment, and God's free will likewise does. But when prayers are answered that are so remarkable that you'd have to believe, amazing coincidences. Those are the occasions that you expect from time to time to happen when God does see it fit. I remember a time when I had a man who had been a friend of mine. He was at odds with me. I had no idea what his complaint was about me, but he wouldn't speak to me. I now have some ideas of what his problem, but it wasn't mine. It was his. But the truth is, I didn't know. I didn't know why he would. And he wouldn't let me email him or call him. And he had been my best friend at one time. I had even had him as a co-host with me on the radio frequently because I liked him so much. And I respected what he had to say so much. But, he became alienated from me for some reason I didn't know. And I was on a drive to Canada, Eastern Canada from Idaho with my children. They were asleep in the back of the car, and I was driving through some state between Canada and Idaho. And I was just praying. I said, God, I want you to please give me an opportunity to talk to this man. I won't say his name right now in case anyone may remember him. But he won't let me see him. So please providentially arrange for me to cross his path. And I pictured crossing his path in the parking lot at a market in our town in Idaho, someplace that we went regularly, but I didn't know what. I just said, please, God, arrange for it. And my children and I stayed in a motel in Billings, Montana. And when we were leaving, I was packing things into the car. I looked across the parking lot, and this man's van and his wife and one of his kids was standing there in shock because they didn't live in Billings, Montana any more than I did. We all lived in Idaho. And they were coming from Idaho going east, and I was going west from Ontario, Canada. This was the next day after I prayed that God would arrange for me to cross the path. And so we did have a talk. It didn't solve things, but God answered my prayer to give. Now, we could say, well, that's a coincidence. Well, it could be, or since it coincides so perfectly with the request and it's so unlikely to have happened by coincidence, I have a rational belief that this was an answered prayer. And there have been many other like them. My whole life, by the way, has been lived by confidence in the promises of God and prayers. Some of you know I live by faith, which means I don't have any guaranteed income, and I don't raise money. I do not have a mailing list. I don't have a list of contributors that I keep in touch with about it. I learned long ago that Jesus didn't do that. Jesus didn't raise money. He just did his Father's will, and things were provided for him as they should be. He never had to raise the issue of money. And Jesus said, if you seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, all these things, and he referred to things you need physically, will be added to you. So I felt like from the time I was young, I believe that. I've lived that way for 55 years. Every bill that I have paid, which, by the way, have always been on time, has been paid without my knowing in advance where the money would come from. God has provided it. Now, I've got long stories about that I'm not going to go into right now. But frankly, if the unbeliever heard the details of these, they would just probably have to conclude I was lying or just think that I live a life that's incredibly lucky so that every month all my bills are paid by people I have no idea who they are in many cases, or that they would give anything and they didn't know that I had a need either. It just happened to be on their heart to give me something at the time. So, I mean, that... I have experience in the faith. In fact, I have so much experience in the faith because I've lived this way for 50-something years that it'd be impossible to convince me that God doesn't exist. Sometimes atheists say, well, what would it take to prove that God doesn't exist? Well, first of all, it would take some evidence that he doesn't exist, which they don't have any. But I'd say it would be about as difficult to prove to me that God doesn't exist as to prove to me that my parents don't exist. You know? I guess you'd have to wake me up and say you've been in a coma for the past many decades and you've been dreaming. I guess that's one way you could prove my parents didn't exist or that God didn't exist. But short of something like that, it can't be done. And this is why I'm still a Christian. Because I'm an evidentialist. I like to go where the evidence points. I have a fair-minded, unbiased approach to the sources of information. I am concerned about the probabilities of things, and comparing the respective probabilities of Christianity being true and other things being true. I have subjected a cost-benefit analysis, though this isn't on my mind very often, but of course it's something that one must think of once in a while. The question of personal experiment, Christianity has worked. Now, have all my prayers been answered? Of course not. The Bible doesn't promise that all my prayers be answered. The prayers that God wants to answer will be the ones answered. And if the atheist says, well, that's a convenient dodge, well, if it wasn't true, I guess it would be a convenient dodge, but it's simply true. The fact that I state it and that it is also convenient for proving my point doesn't make it untrue. I think I know a lot more about what God's done in my life than any atheist knows about what God's done in anyone's life. And so with those things, I would close my exposition on why I'm still a Christian.